is present by telephone and will be, is listening to your oral arguments and will perhaps have questions for you, and he will also be participating fully in the deliberations of the court. Ms. Manlove, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Cynthia Manlove, and I represent Carol Hottenroth in her lawsuit against the Village of Slinger. Carol Hottenroth had worked for a number of years for the Village of Slinger under an apprenticeship contract as a line repairer or lineman. The contract called for, upon her completion of the on-the-job training hours and completion of some classroom work, she would receive her journeyman's card, which is basically a license to practice as a lineman. Some months after she had completed her on-the-job training, and after she had completed the classroom work, she was told by her employer, the Village of Slinger, that they didn't believe she was competent and that they would not be signing off on her apprenticeship card. Now, one of the problems that we have in this case with the district court decision has to do with the question of whether or not that refusal to sign off on the apprenticeship card is an adverse action under Title VII and the retaliation provisions in Title VII. The district judge determined that it was not, in part because the issue of the apprenticeship card was between Hottenroth and the apprenticeship bureau. But that ignores, I think, the reality in this case that the apprenticeship bureau relies upon the employer, in this case, the Village of Slingers, certifying that the apprentice is competent before issuing the card. So it's not just an issue between Carol Hottenroth and the Apprenticeship Bureau. The Apprenticeship Bureau stated repeatedly in the apprenticeship hearing and in some documents which are in the record that they don't make a determination of competency. The employer does, and the employer in this case was the Village of Slinger. Their refusal to certify that competency, even though they had already sent the letter saying she had successfully completed her on-the-job training hours, in essence, totally prevented Carol Hottenroth from getting her journeyman's card.
And what was their stated reason for not having certified her?
The Apprenticeship Bureau's reason?
No, the village.
They argued months after the completion of the on-the-job training hours that she was not competent. They alleged she was not competent.
Why? Why did they say she was not competent?
They said in part that she was not skilled in overhead work. Now, a lineman, depending upon the electric utility, is one of those people that climbs up the electrical poles and does the electrical work up on the lines. In the case of the Village of Slinger, they had only underground lines. There was no opportunity, to a certain extent, to get exposure to the experiences to qualify her in that overhead work.
Went to an adjacent community for that, though, didn't she?
Pardon?
She went to an adjacent community that did have overhead lines to do some of that apprentice work there.
She went there for 2 weeks wherein she helped erect poles. That was as far as that experience went. She did not work with any live electricity at all. She didn't work up on the lines at all. She was involved in the initial installing of the poles for a period of 2 weeks, and that was it.
Did that one time they had to remove her from one of the poles that she climbed up part way?
She had some of her equipment on wrong. She had climbed up part way, and they did take her down from the pole at that point. She had also been certified more than once while she was employed at the Village of Slinger in a pole rescue procedure. They have a safety committee up there that does exercises with the various journeymen and employees involved in that activity, and she had successfully completed a pole top rescue through that process. So we also argued that that was hearsay evidence, which I believe it clearly was, since the person who testified about it wasn't there and didn't see it. And I don't think it's appropriate for the court to rely on that hearsay evidence in reaching some sort of conclusion that results in a decision that she didn't get, that the refusal to sign off was not an adverse action because the village wasn't involved in it. The village very clearly
who required that she sign off on your client's competence? Was this a requirement of the association which certifies these people?
By the Apprenticeship Bureau, Your Honor.
Yes. In addition to certifying the hours and the classroom time, et cetera, there was an independent obligation to sign off with respect to competence? This was not clear in the record. It puzzled me.
Well, and frankly, it wasn't clear from, I think, all the facts that were brought into the case. Normally, Kenneth Moore, who was the chief of the Bureau of Apprenticeship, testified at the apprenticeship hearing that normally successful completion of the hours is adequate to obtain your card. Okay? However, he also said that an employer can raise questions of competency at any point throughout the apprenticeship program, in this case 4 years. And that would be independent of that satisfactory completion of the on-the-job training hours. And what happened in this case is Mary Jo Lang from the village of Slinger picked up the phone and contacted the Apprenticeship Bureau approximately 9 months after she sent the letter saying Carol Hottenroth had successfully completed her hours. 9 months later, she picked up the phone and called the Apprenticeship Bureau and said, I have some concerns about her competency. So normally, the letter saying you've satisfactorily completed is adequate. In this case, Mary Jo Lang picked up the phone, called the Apprenticeship Bureau, and said, by the way, I have some problems with her competencies, after Ms. Hottenroth had been complaining about what she believed was a hostile environment she was experiencing at work.
What precisely had she told Ms. Lang about that hostile environment at that point?
There were repeated discussions starting in about November of 99. When Ms. Lang was early in her employment as the utility manager at Slinger. It was difficult to get a handle on exactly how many discussions, but I think both parties, Ms. Hottenroth and Mary Jo Lang, agree there were repeated and frequent discussions. In the appendix, I believe it shows some of the notes from some of those discussions. Those are a partial reflection of the number and amount of discussions that took place starting in November of 99, frankly, up until the termination of Hottenroth in May of 2001. So there were repeated more than one or two.
Now,
and I think, again, both sides would agree with that.
Had your client gone beyond Ms. Lang in reporting these matters by the time Ms. Lang got in touch with the Bureau about her competence? Had there been any communication with anyone else in the village hierarchy? Had there been any formal charges filed or anything of that nature?
There had not been any formal charges filed, and I don't believe she had gone to anyone else in the village or within the village hierarchy. At that point in time, the staff person from the Bureau of Apprenticeship, who would normally be an additional source for problems that may be occurring in an apprentice's work setting, was vacant. So there was no field or staff representative from the Apprenticeship Bureau she could go to at that point in time. As I think I was stating, there should be no question that this was an adverse action. It wasn't a matter strictly between the Apprenticeship Bureau and Carol Hottenroth. Now, another reason stated by the district judge.
If I may, before you go forward, what flowed between your client and her co-workers, to what degree was that, did the evidence indicate that was based on her gender? Most of the things I've read here indicate they didn't much like her, they didn't much care for her competence. I'm not seeing very much about her gender.
In her deposition, Ms. Hottenroth gave a very long list of different things that occurred, some of which related to her gender. For example, she talked about, I think, while she was employed, she had asked that some nude calendars be removed from the walls, and had made that request to management within the village. The guys in the shop didn't like that. She had a back problem at one point, and she was trying to do some exercises in the garage, and there were some comments made about her body when she's doing those exercises such that she started to do them in the women's room so that she wouldn't be subject to those comments. There was some evidence of comments made not to Ms. Hottenroth but to other people, that evidence of bias against women on the part of the coworkers. So there is some evidence in the record, primarily through the affidavit of, or excuse me, the deposition testimony of Ms. Hoffman.
Does the record affirmatively show that she brought these to the attention of Ms. Lang?
I think, again, her testimony was, yes, she brought those issues to the attention of Ms. Lang. I think Ms. Lang's own notes, to a certain extent, also evidence that. She says at one point, you know, I was worried that the guys were getting on her case again. There were some discussions at the meeting between the Apprenticeship Bureau and Mary Jo Lang and Ms. Hottenroth in, I believe, July of 2000, where there was discussion about, you have to accept this because you're a woman in a non-traditional trade. I had to go through it. You have to go through it, and until you suffer as much as I have, you really can't complain too much. And that was from Ms. Lang. So I don't think there's any question that Ms. Lang understood that there was complaints of sexual harassment, and in fact, to a certain extent, believed that in fact that was true.
But the calendar rule is not really a sexual harassment. I mean, it could be men who would ask to have the calendar. It doesn't really make any difference what gender it is.
You're correct. I think there has to be a distinction drawn between sexual harassment and hostile environment because of sex. Sexual harassment is typically where there's the overtures. They, you know, ask you out. They may make jokes about you to your face that have sexual connotations. A hostile environment can exist where there isn't any sexual connotation to the comments that are made to you, but there's hostilities towards you that are because you're a female or a girl in a man's job. That's what was occurring here. Not sexual harassment. They weren't asking her out, and they weren't giving her a hard time directly because of her sex. They were giving her a hard time because she was a girl.
Or because she had a personality that was offensive, male or female.
And I guess that would have to be a factual dispute that would have to be resolved. The issues of the evidence of sexual harassment or hostile environment, depending upon what term you want to make, or use for it, were never developed because the motion at summary judgment was strictly that it be thrown out because of lack of exhaustion of administrative remedies. There was no development of the facts that would establish a hostile environment or not establish a hostile environment, because the only motion before the court was those claims should be dismissed because they weren't on the face of the discrimination complaint and the plaintiff failed to exhaust her administrative remedies. So, you know, that, I think the amount of evidence, how credible it is, remains to be seen because we never got that far. I believe I'll wait for the rest for rebuttal. As I understand, that means I had 5 minutes left, correct?
Thank you, Ms. Madeline.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Ms. Ford.
May it please the court. Ms. Madeline. I would like to start at the outset by simply making an observation. In my experience, this court is always very careful to review the record to determine the factual accuracies of what the what is represented in the brief and what is represented before the tribunal during oral argument. Some of the things I've heard, quite frankly, surprised me. The nude calendars in the shop allegation, is this the first time I've heard this? I'm not going to say anything more about that. With regard to the issues that are actually before the court, I think we have to clarify what is left in this case. The sexual discrimination claim was addressed by Judge Randa, thoroughly addressed, and it was dismissed. And it was not, that claim was not the subject of the appeal in this case. In fact, the dismissal of the sexual discrimination claim based upon the discipline for rummaging through the office, the suspension, and the termination, those issues were never briefed before this court. So I would ask that those issues be deemed waived because we were never given an opportunity to argue.
I gather counsel's point is that some of the same evidence supports her claim of hostile work environment.
That's correct, and for the same reason. If we were to accept the hostile work environment claim as it's currently defined by counsel, that claim would also have to be deemed waived because there is sexual harassment that occurs by virtue of discrete discriminatory acts, adverse job actions. And then there is sexual harassment that occurs by virtue of statements, sexually specific statements. The sex discrimination claim that was briefed before the district court was a pure adverse employment claim based upon the suspension, the termination, and the alleged failure to recommend the issuance of the apprenticeship card. And that was not briefed before this court and on this appeal. So what we have essentially before the court is whether or not Judge Randa applied an incorrect legal standard in determining whether Ms. Hottentrott was subject to an adverse employment action in the context of a retaliation claim, because this is all we have before the court. I'm assuming and hoping that the court will deem the other matter waived. And also whether Ms. Hottentrott exhausted her administrative remedies on a sexual harassment claim. The issues before the district court that have been abandoned are the sex discrimination claim. And I think that would include the currently defined hostile environment claim. So we're left with the question, first of all, of what is an adverse employment action in the retaliation context? Yes, it is different in the retaliation context than that adverse employment action definition that's employed in regular discrimination claims. What has this court said about the meaning of that? In Johnson versus Cambridge Industries, Justice Wood stated that retaliation requires proof that the employer did something to cause the employee what, in Justice Wood's phrasing, was real harm. Let's talk about the recommendation that Ms. Hottentrott not be given her apprenticeship card, her lineman's card. That, in fact, didn't occur. What occurred, factually, was that we asked for an extension for a year to allow her to have additional training because she was obviously fearful of live electricity. When she climbed that pole, she froze. She testified to this. She could not get down. We had to bring in Cedarburg, Wisconsin, had to bring in a bucket truck to pluck her off the pole. This was because of fear. It was not because of lack of equipment, and this is Ms. Hottentrott's own testimony. Not only that, the decision to ask for this additional year to allow Ms. Hottentrott more training was made 3 months before and communicated to Ms. Hottentrott. I'm sorry, 3 months after. Wait, 3 months before. It was made in June, in late June of 2000. Ms. Hottentrott and Ms. Lang met and discussed this with Ms. Robitussi from the Bureau of Apprenticeship Standards in July of 2000. The first discrimination complaint was not filed until October of 2000. So Ms. Lang, in order to have retaliated based upon this particular action, would have had to basically have been prescient and would have had to know that a discrimination complaint was going to be filed. Ms. Hottentrott specifically testified that the meeting that occurred at the end of June of 2000, when she was told she was not going to be recommended right away for a lineman's card and that this extension was going to be requested, she was told, she told Ms. Lang for the first time, and this is her testimony, that she felt she was the subject of sex discrimination. So that can't be the adverse employment action that can be the subject of the retaliation claim. We also talk about other items. Ms. Lang doesn't have the authority to issue the apprenticeship card, and Judge Randall recognizes this. What she does have the authority to do is tell the people at the Apprenticeship Bureau standards if she has some concerns about the safety issues of any given employee who's subject to her training. She went out, she observed Ms. Hottenroth. She observed her fear of live electricity. Ms. Hottenroth acknowledged her fear of live electricity to Ms. Lang during the meetings and to Ms. Robichowski during the meetings to extend her contract. So that can't, that in and of itself can't constitute an adverse employment action. Ms. Lang testified, and Judge Randall wanted to point this out, and he said, this is critical. Ms. Lang never said she was not going to ultimately recommend Ms. Hottenroth after this extension period. And Judge Randall pointed this out. She testified to exactly the opposite, that she had not made a decision and that she was fully prepared for the possibility that the recommendation would have been made. So that can't be the basis for the retaliation claim. There's no real harm there. Now, she also never had an opportunity to make the decision because Ms. Hottenroth was terminated for what she acknowledges was insubordination, rank insubordination, 2 months before the extension period ended. So Ms. Lang was never allowed the opportunity to decide whether or not she was going to make the recommendation or not. There's no real harm there. Now, there was a meeting that occurred on March 1st of 2001. And during that meeting, Ms. Hottenroth asked Ms. Lang, if I don't get my card, do you think another position could be created for me here? And I'm not going to comment on the wisdom of this. This person is my client, but Ms. Lang said to her, you know, I don't think I can sell that to the board. I can't sell that to the board. You know, you filed a complaint. She spoke without the authorization of the board. She had not spoken to the board about creating a position. She was speculating, and she acknowledged that in deposition. And that can't be the basis for an adverse employment decision. In fact, Justice Taney held in Ajayi, and I'm probably completely mispronouncing that, that an unfulfilled threat which results in no material harm is not an adverse employment action as a matter of law. So while quite frankly questionable in nature, it's not an adverse employment action. It did not cause her the kind of real harm that's required to support a retaliation claim. And Judge Randall also correctly decided that there was just no actionable real harm done to Ms. Hottenroth. This is equally true with regard to the disposition of the sexual harassment claim and the issue of whether or not administrative remedies were exhausted. Ms. Hottenroth filed an EEOC complaint. She filed 3 EEOC complaints. The only sexual harassment allegations made in any of these complaints in either the boxes or the descriptions that the EEOC provides to describe the claim were in the first complaint, and we settled that claim. She did not make an attempt to revive a sexual harassment claim in the second complaint she filed or the third complaint she filed. The first time I saw sexual harassment, other than general allegations regarding hostile environment, which really weren't gender specific, in my opinion, attached to these exhibits, no one was on notice that a hostile environment sexual harassment claim was made. The investigators who investigated these 2 complaints didn't investigate a sexual harassment claim. They never saw it. It wasn't alleged. So what they investigated were claims for sex discrimination and claims for retaliation. We never got the opportunity to defend against a sexual harassment claim. When it was raised at the federal court level, I was, I guess, quite surprised to see that because I thought we settled that claim and had not expected to.
What did the second 2 EEOC claims contend?
The second 2 EEOC claims, give me just a moment, I'll find it. The first complaint was filed, she alleged sex discrimination and retaliation. And that was on March 5 of 2000. I beg your pardon. Let me go back up. The first complaint was filed on October 19th of 2000. She alleged she was the victim of hostile environment harassment on the basis of her gender at the hands of her supervisor and her coworker, Dennis Fitzgerald. The second complaint she filed was filed on March 5 of 2001. She alleged sex discrimination and retaliation. And the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development determined that there was no probable cause to believe that discrimination occurred. In the probable cause finding, there's no indication that the investigator interpreted that complaint to allege sexual harassment. In fact, that claim was not investigated. In her third complaint, she alleged sex discrimination and retaliation arising out of her May 29, 2001 termination, because by then she was terminated. Again, the investigator there did not treat that complaint as alleging anything other than sex discrimination and retaliation. No investigation was done then regarding sexual harassment. The only complaint that was subject to investigation on a sexual harassment theory was the complaint that we settled. So Judge Randa was never allowed the opportunity, I beg your pardon, Judge Randa pointed out in his decision that the very purpose of having parties go through the administrative forum would be defeated by allowing Ms. Hottenroth to bring a claim in federal court that she did not allege, so that the employer was put on notice, that the employer had some claims to defend, and so that the investigator, the EEOC, was put on notice sufficient to be able to determine whether or not that claim could be conciliated. I think that decision was a correct one. She points out in her reply brief that there's only one box that you can check on these discrimination complaint forms. That's not true. There is a form that allows for a narrative description. I don't want to give up the argument concerning the alternative basis for the dismissal of the state law claim for breach of contract, given the fairly complicated statutory setup for dealing with alleged breach of apprenticeship standards contracts. And Ms. Hottenroth, that was the fourth action that she filed, and that action has been before that tribunal, and she has been allowed relief that she actually has not taken advantage of. This is the process. The Apprenticeship Bureau asked her to prove her competence before they would give her card. She declined to exercise that opportunity. So I am not aware that she has her card to this day. But without waiving that argument, I won't go further in it. Unless the court has any questions for me, I will sit down.
Thank you, Ms. Ford.
Thank you.
Ms. Matlove, you have 2 minutes.
I'll start with, I think, where she finished. And this has been a disagreement, I think, between the two parties. Ms. Hottenroth was never actually afforded the opportunity to show her competency. It was never scheduled. It was never arranged for. It's not a simple thing to do. And for a whole bunch of reasons, and I'll keep it brief as Ms. Ford did, it's not accurate to say she's been afforded an opportunity to prove her competency. She has not. All right. I also want to talk about the administrative exhaustion argument. All right. Ms. Ford apparently is arguing that whether or not the Wisconsin Equal Rights Division investigates a claim is determinative as to whether or not the administrative remedy has been exhausted. And that is not a correct analysis. Okay, I think in actually the case of Haugerud versus Amory School District, 259 F. 3rd, 678, the court was faced with the same kind of question. And the court held that Title VII plaintiffs may bring claims that were included in her EEOC charge or that are likely or reasonably related to the allegations of the charge and growing out of such allegations. The judge, in his decision, said the exhibits attached to her charges, and that includes the second and third one, which are, by the way, the final pages of the appendix, do reference instances which could form the basis for a hostile environment claim. The judge made our case. He agrees. They were there on the complaint. That is adequate to not be dismissed for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. What the judge additionally said, however, is that he concluded that these instances were merely background for the sex discrimination claim. How he reached that conclusion, on what evidence, I have no idea. But I would argue that he doesn't have the authority to go beyond his analysis, which said the instances are there on the complaint. That should be enough, and he should not be able to take it further based on no evidence in the record to support his conclusion. And the red light passes. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mangold. Indeed, our thanks to both you and to Ms. Ford for your fine presentations. The case will be taken under advisement.